Hi, I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is the Marketplace Weekend Podcast for the weekend of October 10th, 2014. When you talk about economics, it's pretty much a given that you're going to talk about trends, a set of data points, collection of anecdotes, a bunch of common human behaviors. But sometimes we go all Robert Frost and follow a different path. I'm Lizzie O'Leary, and this is Marketplace Weekend, where the economy collides with real life. Our show today is all about going your own way. It's happening often in our current economy. Big lumbering industries just don't work like they used to. Music, publishing, even how we get our food. Technology makes them easier to blow up. Sometimes with great results, sometimes not so much. Either way, we get distinct original stories. Come share your stories at MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter at MarketplaceWKND. And now let's get things going and round up your economic week in 20 seconds.
Former AIG CEO Hank Greenberg's case being heard in court now, in which Greenberg is suing, saying the terms of the bailout were onerous to shareholders.
Stocks have been on a wild ride, volatile due to all kinds of worries.
Online retailer Amazon is looking to give its web-based business a touch of real-world customer service. The company is reportedly planning to build a physical store on New York City's 34th Street.
Also this week, the audio platform company SoundCloud hit an impasse in negotiations with three of the world's biggest record labels. SoundCloud wants to bring music from Sony, Universal, and Warner to their platforms. The labels are holding out for more money. Of course, the past 15 years have been rough for the recording industry. The Recording Industry Association of America recently put out their mid-year report. It showed that revenue across the business is down almost 5% from last year. Audiences are getting their music from places like Spotify and Pandora. But in the indie scene, there's hope those numbers can turn around. And that hope revolves around comedy. We turn now to independent producer John Sepulvedo, who's based in Portland, Oregon, with our first story of Going Your Own Way. Hi, John.
Hi, Lizzie.
So you've been looking into this comedy thing, the new hope, I guess, for the recording industry?
I have, and this week I've been specifically focused on supply.
Sort of supply and demand, I guess? What do you mean by the supply part of this?
By supply, I mean the comics themselves. So take Niraj Srinivasan. He used to play music. He's young. He's got this dark, curly, floppy hair. When I meet him, he's wearing jeans, and he has this Lucky Charms t-shirt.
Right, the cereal.
Right. And he looks like the kind of guy you would see in a Pabst ad or something like that.
Very Portland hipster.
Very Portland hipster. And I met him at an open mic here in Portland where about 30 other performers took turns testing out new material. And for a guy like Srinivasan, he says part of the appeal of comedy is that, unlike being in a band, he doesn't need all the equipment, he doesn't need the connections of getting to know people, he doesn't need to be as plugged in to a clique.
But I feel like with comedy, you know, I can, you know, walk into any town, and if there's a room, ask for some time, and just, you know, with whatever the clothes I have on my back, I can get up and I perform.
This isn't a wig, it's a weave! No, exactly. like Brody said, my name is Niraj, I'm 23 years old.
Basically, he just needs his jokes and a mic and an audience.
But I mean, is this something where he sees a future?
He totally sees a future, and he does for two reasons. The first is that Srinivasan says people listen to comedy in a different way than they listen to music.
With a band, you know, you can listen to a couple of songs and kind of get an idea of what their music is like, you know, where they're coming from, what kind of story they're trying to tell. But with a comic, to truly appreciate and understand the performer, you have to be able to take in as much as they have to offer.
Do you hope to make money off this one day?
Absolutely. Every day, you know, I'm out after, you know, I do have a day job in the morning that, you know, I work every single weekday, and weeknights included, I'm out every single day at the open mics if I don't have a showcase, really just working whatever stage time I can come up with.
And so, Lizzie, what we're seeing on the supply side is a ton of new young comics hitting the club circuits in Portland and around the country for the reasons that Srinivasan listed.
So in other places around the country, back that up for me. Give me some other data.
This is really coming from anecdotal reports. There's not.
You mean there's no comedy census?
Yeah, there's no comedy census. Exactly. But from these anecdotal reports, and a lot of them are coming in newspapers and alt weeklies that are around the country. For example, in Philadelphia last year, the paper there, The Inquirer, wrote about a bustling new comedy scene. The same thing in Houston. And then there's San Francisco, Seattle, even Minneapolis. And then there are places like Miami where there's been a rash of comedy room closures, but you're still seeing smaller venues actively inviting comedy acts in. And those small clubs are important to developing young talent. So on the supply side, the actual number of comics that are kind of entering the workforce, if you will, it looks like there could be a generation's worth of comedic talent.
That's John Sepulveda reporting for us from Portland. Thanks a lot, John.
Anytime, Lizzie.
And there's more to that story just ahead. You're listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. You heard about the supply of new comic talent coming through the pipeline. Now we're going to talk about the demand side of that equation. Portia Sabin runs Kill Rock Stars Records. If you listen to Bikini Kill, Slater Kinney, or Elliot Smith, you've heard some of their music. And they've earned a reputation for going their own way and being out in front of the next cool thing. Now Kill Rock Stars is betting on comedy. Portia Sabin joins us from her office in Portland. Welcome to Marketplace Weekend.
Thank you.
Why don't you tell me why you guys decided to get into comedy in the first place?
Well, we've been comedy fans for years, and we have been talking about putting out comedy records for years. We had been. And what basically happened was we didn't know how to do it because our models were like Sub Pop, who had put out sort of some scattered comedy here and there, but they were kind of bigger people who'd already been famous. And we kind of didn't know. We were like, should we just call David Cross and say, hey, do you want to do another album with us? I mean, we just didn't really know how to go about it. And we, you know, we thought, because the other option is, you know, should we start putting out small up-and-comers from our hometown?
Yeah.
And the decision got made for us when we retweeted something that Kurt Brownoler tweeted. And then he immediately tweeted, oh my God, I just got retweeted by Kill Rock Stars. My 14-year-old self is freaking out. And within an hour, I was on the phone with him and we were making a deal for a record because we were huge fans of his. And it's just taken off like that in this really organic manner. We keep getting contacted by people who we just love and who are sort of the next person that we would have logically reached out to ourselves. And they keep coming to us. So we're very fortunate at this time.
You guys have this stable of people. You've got Kurt Brownoler, you've got Hari Kondabolu, you've got Cameron Esposito. It feels kind of like the stable of people who you were working with as a music label when I think back to Bikini Kill. I feel like you kind of have this punk rock edge, but in the comedy world. Am I reading too much into that?
No, that's exactly what I think too. That's how it feels to me. You know, the label started 23 years ago with exactly that aesthetic. You know, we wanted to put out people who had something to say, people who were political, people who were making noise in the community. And so we did end up with a stable of really exciting artists like Bikini Kill, Bratmobile, Huggy Bear. And yeah, and so now the comedians feel exactly the same to me.
How have your comedy albums sold in the past year compared to your music albums?
Well, our two comedy releases that we put out in the last 12 months have sold better than all the other records we have put out in the last 12 months combined.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
It's pretty wild. You know, I'm sure everyone is familiar with how difficult things have been in the music business lately. But I didn't know if that was going to carry over to comedy as well, but it really doesn't seem to. And I think one of the reasons is because comedy is not seen as a singles format. When someone wants to hear a comedy album by their favorite comedian, they want to hear the whole thing. You know, it's sort of like getting back to the days of concept albums. You know, people actually wanted to buy it and sit down and listen to it from beginning to end. And I think that's really what's happening in comedy, because we definitely don't see a lot of the cherry picking or the, you know, maybe one song here, one song there that we would see with the regular albums we're putting out.
So no one's going out and saying, I'm going to buy this bit. They buy the whole thing.
Right. Exactly. They want to hear the whole thing.
I'm curious if you've thought about why, you know, besides even just the single track phenomenon, why is it that comedy sells so well right now?
I think that the prevalence of podcasts has reached a lot of people. I think a lot of people listen to podcasts and a lot of people become familiar with people who would have been otherwise more obscure because of their podcast, especially like Cameron has two podcasts that she does weekly. And as a result, I think people have a taste for that. And I think people are get excited about comedians more. And also, I just think people are really hungry. I mean, that's, I feel like it's the same as it was in the early 90s with the musicians. Like, people are really hungry for people who've got something to say, you know, people who've got an opinion and some thoughts about stuff. I think we've really had a period in the arts in America over the last few years of real docility, if you know what I mean. Everyone's just been sort of like, let's hold hands and sing songs that are nice and pretty. And, you know, no, like, where's the protest music? You know, where's the anger? And I feel like we've got a lot to be angry about these days. And the place where that's coming out seems to be in comedy.
I've got to imagine, being in the music business, you talk to people at other labels. Do you guys talk about, hey, maybe you should get into comedy here?
Well, I don't want to give anyone else the good idea of doing that. You know, I can't imagine we're going to be the only indie label that has thought this was a good idea. But right now, I'm happy that we are where we are.
Who's buying your stuff? What's your demographic?
In general, the demographic for our artists is older people, people over 30.
Hey, now, we're not that old.
Yeah, we are. Some of us are. Maybe not you, but definitely me.
Portia Sabin, president of Kill Rock Stars, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
And that brings us to the weekend number. It's 18. That's the total number of tracks on Cameron Esposito's new album. She's a comedian signed to the Kill Rock Stars label. For at least 2 days, those 18 tracks were the most downloaded on Apple's iTunes, suggesting Kill Rock Stars' bet on comedy is paying off, at least for now. The sky is blue most every day. Stay tuned. There's more Marketplace Weekend coming up just after this break. Every day, you and I interact with the world of tech.
Today, we're going to be showing our friends the basics of technology.
This cellular phone features 832-channel capacity, 30-number memory speed dialing, last number redial, electronic lock while not in use, adjustable volume control, horn alert option included.
This is tech in real life.
Ben Johnson is the host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Hi, Ben.
Hi, Lizzie.
So what are we doing out here on the street today?
Well, we're preparing to go into a Kiko Cafe. It's this place that does not apparently allow cell phones.
No cell phones.
No cell phones.
I've got my phone with me.
Yes.
You've got your phone with you.
I've got
you.
My phone out here. I'm going to turn mine off because okay. I'm scared and I don't like to get yelled at.
All right. Well, that's fine. We'll turn our phones off.
I know. I'm scared, but I think we're going to make it. All right. Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. So here we are inside, and there, in fact, is the sign. No cellular phones.
Okay. Well, it's nice. It's nice in here. Nobody's looking at their phone.
All right, Ben. So we are not using our cell phones. Is this a real thing? Is this a trend, the no cell phone zone?
Well, it's interesting. It's starting to happen more and more because, as you and I both know, people use their smartphones all the time now in many, many different venues, many different places.
You would get in trouble having dinner with my mother if you did that.
Yes, and I think you would get in trouble also having dinner with my parents, and maybe with me, too. I feel like if you're on your phone the whole time that we're trying to hang out together,
yeah.
Right? But this is becoming more and more popular. So actually in San Francisco, there's a venue called the Stork Club that is using cell phone jamming technology, and it's called Yonder. This is Yondr. It's without the E. The venue actually gives these little pouches to all of the people who come into the club. The pouches lock, and you have to put your phone into it while you're in the club. The pouch locks. You can keep the phone on your person, of course, but if you actually want to use the phone, it's a cloth it's a little cloth pouch so you can feel it vibrate. But if you actually want to use your phone, you have to like swipe it against the unlocking device and leave the club in order to use your phone.
All right, the pouch, that seems like one thing, but there are other forms of jamming technology that are out there. Are those being used?
Yes. Well, so there are actual cell phone jammers. And the way that these things work is your cell phone, like many of your devices, uses radio waves, right? That's how we communicate with our cell phones. That's how cell phones talk to cell towers and vice versa. So there are these cell phone jammers that exist. They cost between $200 and $400. And what they do is they take up all of that radio bandwidth that your phone might use in a given area and thus prevent your phone from talking to the tower and vice versa. It's actually kind of like a denial of service attack, if you've heard of those on websites where someone will just send a bunch of traffic to the website so no other traffic can actually visit the website. And this is actually very similar to that. It's something that is out there, but it's actually not used all that often.
So why don't we see them in places like, say, a movie theater where, you know, one call or a loud beep from a text can drive you totally bananas if it pops up in the middle of, you know, a dramatic scene?
Yes. Well, this is a very good question, and the answer is actually, in the United States, cell phone jamming is illegal. Even advertising jammers is illegal. So there's a couple different reasons for this. So as near as I can tell, it actually relates to a piece of legislation in the 30s that is about broadcast communications. And it's been around for actually a long time. It's the Communications Act of 1934. Now, you can get fined over $100,000 if you use a jammer to interfere with Wi-Fi signal, radio signal, signals of any other kind. Recently, the Homeland Security Act was passed in 2002. I guess not that recently, but over 10 years ago now, but still. And that seems to actually override this Communications Act of 1934 in certain instances. So you can imagine a time in which the U.S. government might, in a national emergency, want to jam certain radio frequencies in order to protect us from terrorism, anything like that. So there are certain cases, but in the U.S., illegal to use and also illegal to advertise. And it really depends country to country.
So for you and me and the general person, we're sort of stuck with like, hey, buddy, would you turn that off? Or if you're me and you enjoy traveling by train and sitting in the quiet car.
As you do.
An aggressive shush.
Yes.
A pointed glare.
Yes. And this is actually, this is why, for instance, when you go to the movies, they have this announcement at the beginning of the movie where they say, please turn your cell phones off. Or, you know, when you go into a theater for an event or in the quiet car, you're expected to do this. And we basically have to rely on shaming and politely asking people to turn off their cell phones.
Ben Johnson, host of Marketplace Tech and our guide to tech in real life. Thank you for talking with us.
Thanks, Lizzie. Let's get out of here so we can turn our phones back on.
You can get some of our tech in your life. Download the Marketplace app. You can get it from the iTunes Store or on Google Play. Here's a question for you. What does Enron have in common with a fish? Well, the Supreme Court of the United States is considering that. It's a case that shows you how a business far away from yours might affect you in ways you never imagined. See, back after Enron collapsed, a law called Sarbanes-Oxley made it a crime to destroy documents and other tangible objects. It turns out tangible objects might include fish. A commercial fisherman in the Gulf Coast named John Yates caught a bunch of grouper under the legal size limit, and Fish and Wildlife ordered him to bring them to port. He allegedly tossed him overboard instead and was charged with destroying tangible objects under Sarbanes-Oxley. We wanted to get a sense of how this case is playing in the Gulf, a place famous for people who go their own way. So we called up Dean Blanchard. He runs a seafood company in Grand Isle, Louisiana. I asked him to tell us about his business.
What we do is we buy seafood straight from the fishermen that actually go out there and catch it. We buy it, we sort it, we fix it, and we distribute it throughout the country.
I'm curious, when you heard about this Supreme Court case, what did you think?
Well, it brought back old memories. I mean, basically, I've been through the same thing. the fisheries enforcement in general are just out of control. You wake up in the morning, you go to work, you don't know if you'll end up in jail by the end of the day.
Really?
It's something. It's unbelievable. The first 20 years I've been in business, we never had that trouble. But the last 10 years or so, it's just been real tough.
I understand you operate under kind of a book of rules. What is that?
Well, what they do when you buy a license, they give you a book of rules. But as soon as you open up the book, on the first page, there's a disclaimer that says, this is not the official rules. This is only an attempt by the author to write down the rules. So you're working in a game where you don't even really know what the rules are. I'm sure Mr. Yates didn't have no idea that he could be hit with the charge that they charged him with. I mean, who ever heard of that?
You have been working on Grand Isle for a long time. Your name is very well known in southern Louisiana. I wonder, have you talked to other folks in your business about this case?
We talk about this every day. I mean, every day. It's this case, and there's plenty of other ones like it. I mean, just not everybody makes it up to the Supreme Court.
I wonder what it feels like that the law that was passed after the Enron scandal applies to fish.
Well, what they charged me with was a law that was done in the 1800s that applied to lions and tigers.
Tell me about that.
They enacted a law in the early 1800s that was against the law to transport lions and tigers across state lines. And back in the early 90s, when the Fed started regulating the red snapper, all they did was apply that law to what they said I did.
Now, on the other hand, you live on the Gulf of Mexico, and you know, you and I have both seen that the dead zones are out there. There are federal laws set in place to help conserve the Gulf. Doesn't it make sense that the feds get to write some of those laws and enforce them?
Well, I mean, look what happened with BP. The feds were in charge of monitoring BP to make sure they did the right thing out there. The feds didn't do their job. BP spilled all over the Gulf. And who's the first one to collect? The federal government. Go figure that out.
Are you going to watch this case to see what happens?
I'm very interested in it. I've been reading it all night, and I hope Mr. Yates comes out all right. But you're fighting against a government that's using your money to fight against you. The odds are not in Mr. Yates' favor.
Dean Blanchard, thank you so much for talking to me.
Thank you. You have a nice day.
Listening to Marketplace Weekend from APM. And since it's the weekend, we thought we'd get a few friends together and talk about what's happening in the news. So let's have brunch. We are out having brunch at the Pullman Kitchen, New York, on 2nd Avenue, and I am joined by Mina Kimes, who is a senior writer at ESPN The Magazine, and Shane Farrow, economics reporter at Business Insider. Welcome to you both. Cheers.
Cheers.
A lot of people have been talking about the NFL. Another part of pro sports, but you wrote about baseball and the management problem, if we want to call it that, and the gender divide there. Tell me about what's going on in MLB front offices.
Sure. Well, yeah, like you mentioned, the NFL has sort of captured everyone's attention right now, and because of sort of their failed handling of the Ray Rice suspension, they've been hiring more women. So I was looking into the numbers in the NFL, and then when I started looking at sort of the amount of gender diversity in baseball, I was surprised by the fact that actually baseball is trending in the wrong direction. There are fewer women in executive positions.
And those numbers are going down?
They're going down, actually. Right, yeah. So, you know, one number that really caught my eye was that I think about less than a third of the women in the employees in the front office now are women. In the mid-90s, it was more than half.
How does that stack up to other sports?
So it's pretty comparable to football. The NBA is actually has much greater diversity, both racial and in terms of gender, than the other leagues.
you know, we talk about sports a lot on this show because it's a massive business when you think about pro sports and college sports. Mm-hmm. But how does the gender picture, do you think, make a difference if you're talking about how this kind of ripples out into sure. society?
Well, I'll say, first of all, those numbers that I described, you know, a third of employees in front office, even much smaller percentages when you're looking at senior employees, those reflect the broader economy. I mean, if you look at Fortune 500 companies, you'll see similar ratios. So it's not like sports are actually worse than other industries, which I think is important to keep in context. But, you know, sports are a mirror to society. And when you see leagues making terrible decisions like the NFL has lately, you begin to wonder who's making the decisions, why are they making such poor decisions, and that sort of turns the focus onto the executive suite.
You know, we're three women sitting around talking about the economy and these different lenses that we look at it through. I'm sort of wondering if this surprises you at all, that we keep coming back to these themes. You guys are both a little bit younger than I am. I wonder if you're struck by that at all, that we're still having this conversation.
I think it's surprising because by now there's just been so much research and so many studies showing how detrimental it is from a business perspective. Forget the social imperative. Businesses do better when there are more women and more diverse boards. You know, I mean, it's a no-brainer. And look at baseball. Half of their fans are women. So, you know, when we're talking about executives, I'm not talking about scouts necessarily or people in baseball operations or jobs that might require playing experience. I'm talking about sales, marketing, ticket strategy, you know. And if half of your customer base is female, why isn't that reflected, you know, in the C-suite?
Shane, let's talk about AIG. I can't believe we're having, this is like the zombie story that won't die. Back in court, Hank Greenberg, the colorful, ever colorful AIG, what, kingpin, founder, who knows? He wants his, he wants money from the government.
Yeah, I think he just wants his name associated with AIG again. I don't know. I'm very amused by this story.
Tell me why.
Because basically what happened is a couple of years ago, Hank Greenberg, who used to run AIG but then was kicked out before the financial crisis, but is still a major shareholder in AIG, he brought a lawsuit against the government for basically not having done the bailout of AIG correctly.
Right, he said they didn't pay shareholders enough money, that they punished them.
Yeah, and so he wants, I think, $25 million from the government for them not giving him enough money during the bailout. The funny thing is, had the government not bailed out AIG, he would have been left with no money. So this is kind of an absurd lawsuit.
And it's a relitigation of the financial crisis in a lot of ways. We're seeing a lot of the players, you know, the former Treasury Secretary Tim Geithner hauled up on there. Have we learned anything about what the crisis did to Americans?
Not from this lawsuit. From what I understand, I haven't been at the trial, but from what I have understand from reading about it is that the witnesses that Greenberg is calling are mostly hostile, and there's Tim Geithner testified, and he said, "I don't know a lot." They asked some questions. He said, "I can't recall. I'm not sure." And so they really haven't gotten much out of him at all.
It's sort of this, I don't know, I feel like he's standing, and I think, Mina, you mentioned this to me before we sat down. Geithner's like a stand-in for America, which was like, that was rough, man, let's move on.
Right. I just want to work at Warburg Pincus now, make some money, sell some books. This might help that, but I mean, I think, you know, if anything, what does this say about where we are as a country? It says that no one really covered themselves in glory during this period. All these characters are coming back, and it's like Scream 5. You're like, Jesus, you again? You again? Nev Campbell? What? You know, like, nobody wants to see these guys. No one's impressed by it. You know, I mean, and they're back, and I was laughing because, you know, I cover sports now. I used to write about business, and I saw this story, and I was just like, yeah, I don't really want to read this.
Yeah.
This was scary.
Well, and I think there could be theoretically a place for some sort of trial that would be very cathartic, to have some sort of trial and really try to understand what went on in the government during this period. But this is not that trial.
Shane Farrow from Business Insider, Mina Kimes from ESPN the Magazine, thank you both so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Marketplace shows and staff like to get out of the studio and do our thing live on stage. Next week, you can see it for yourself. Our next stop for the Marketplace Roadshow, How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Numbers, is in New York City, October 16th at the 92nd Street Y. On stage, ballerina Misty Copeland, author Delia Ephron, just to name a couple. And we'll have a slew of Marketplace reporters as well. Tickets are at 92y.org, and there's more Marketplace Weekend just ahead. Last week on the show, we asked for stories about whether you've cut out the middleman in this economy and gone your own way. And lots of you visited marketplaceweekend.org and wrote about going digital, saving money, or doing it yourself. We'll get to those stories, but first, what about all those middlemen and women? What's happening to them? Well, here's one with her side of the story.
I'm a travel consultant and team leader at Liberty Travel in downtown Los Angeles, and at the moment I'm sitting in my back office as we speak. I've been working as a travel agent for just over 4 years. I started in Australia, was there for a couple of years, and now in the US. I think one of the biggest myths, I guess, is that we charge a fee to plan somebody's vacation, but that's actually not the case. So someone would come to myself for, travel advice and to help them plan their vacation, because I've been all over the world. I've been to every continent except Antarctica. So I have a wealth of knowledge and a wealth of experience for myself. If I hadn't been somewhere, one of my colleagues will have been there, or we will have sent a client there. So we have first-hand experience and first-hand knowledge, rather than, you having to, sorting through the internet and all the options on your own. We're paid by our vendors. So people like Delta, want us to sell their tickets. It's easy for them to have an agent who's an expert to sell their ticket on their behalf, so then they pay us back end rather than you as a client having to do that. So the internet is a middleman as well, I guess, as us. The biggest difference is we'll actually talk to you and we'll find out exactly what you want and what's right for you and your family, or you and your partner, or you and your girlfriends, rather than you having to guess when you're online. My favorite destination in the last couple of years has been Egypt. It was absolutely phenomenal. Went during all the chaos that was over there, but it was the most incredible, mind-blowing experience. I am my own travel agent. It's always a team effort when I travel, because I often travel with other agents. So we all bring something to the table.
And now to your stories, and there were a lot of them. We asked you last week if you've cut out the middleman. Did it work? Was it a disaster? And tons of you wrote in about going your way. And, well, we called you back.
Hi, this is Cassandra Griffin, and I live in South Holland, Illinois.
Tell me when you cut out the middleman.
I decided it was finally time to paint the living room. I painted every other room in the house except the living room. And I decided to get a quote on getting the painting job done. And I had a number in my head, maybe around $250, maybe $300. And the person who came said $850. I was put aback. I'm like, is he kidding? I was really stunned. I was literally shocked because that was not in my realm that it was going to cost that much. I was just motivated to do it myself. It did take a week of my life. And there were times during the process when I thought, maybe it was worth $850, but I was already in it, so I couldn't stop. I had to keep going. And now I have the satisfaction of saying I did it, and it looks pretty darn good if I say so myself.
Now that you've done this, do you think it's something you might do again or in other areas of your life?
I recently, about a year ago, retired from my federal government job. And so now I really have to look at my expenditures a little bit differently, whereas in the past, maybe I would have thought $850 wasn't a big deal, but now it is a big deal. So I pay attention to how I'm spending my money now.
Cassandra Griffin, thank you so much for talking with us.
My name is Jamie Cool, and I live in the mountains of northwestern North Carolina.
How have you cut out the middleman?
We have no electric bill, no heat bill, no water bill, no sewer bill. We grow a lot of our own food. I'd say probably 70% of our own food. We preserve. We have 60 beehives. We have laying chickens, and we also have chickens for meat.
Wow. What have you learned doing that?
That it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience.
What are the economics of doing all of that yourself?
There's always an equation. We ask ourselves if it's affordable, if it's cheaper in the long run to do something ourselves as opposed to purchasing something or having something repaired. Just jumping into something and not researching first can definitely not be a financially smart decision.
And how has the money part of it worked out for you, do you think?
We are actually to the point now where we are saving money and we are actually making money. We do the farmer's market. You know, there's always an initial investment in anything you're going to do yourself. So you really want to make sure that it's going to be that you research and that it's going to be a long-term thing.
Jamie Cool, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
My name is Michael Tiller. I live in Canton, Michigan.
You have written a couple of books, but I gather the experiences were very different.
So I wrote a book in 2001, and I wasn't very happy with the experience. The involvement of the publisher ended up increasing the price of the book quite a bit, and I was really going for accessibility in writing that book. I really wanted to get the information out to people who were trying to learn. I thought about it, and I decided almost a decade later to write a book on the same topic, but this time remove the publisher part, self-publish it, but also flip the entire sort of business model around, whereas before it was a royalty-based where I would get money as books are sold. I flipped it around for the second book and turned it into a Kickstarter project, enlisted a bunch of essentially corporate support, people who were vendors who wanted quality documentation around this topic, and got them to essentially front all the money with the understanding that the book would have a free HTML version. So that solved my problem of making the book accessible to people, and it also ended up that I made more money before I wrote the book than I made with the previous book after a whole decade of sales.
Did this experience make you think about, you know, cutting out the middleman in other parts of your life?
Technology is an amazing thing when it comes to these kinds of things. Kickstarter is a good example. You know, I'm always looking for those kinds of technologies that can help pull some friction out of the whole process. If people are adding value to the process, then I think that's fine to have a middleman. The problem is when they're not really adding value. When they're, you know, like in the case of publishers, I think a lot of that is built around the idea that you sort of have to go through a publisher in order for it to be credible, or you have to go through publishers to get access to the sales channels or something like that. But at some point, that value isn't really a value anymore. I mean, you have access to the sales channels more directly. So I don't know. I mean, it's just something you always have to look at and think, okay, is this person in the process really adding value? And if they're not, then you can. Technology is an amazing way of enabling people to skip over them.
Michael Tiller, thank you so much for taking the time to talk to us.
Yeah, well, thanks for taking interest.
My name's Eric Matt. I'm from Marlboro, Vermont.
When did you cut out the middleman?
I bought a house, and I didn't use a realtor. I'm a lawyer or a bank.
How exactly did that work?
I had a fair amount of money saved. I did really well on Apple stock. I bought Apple stock in 2004 and 5, and so I had a fair amount, but not enough to buy the house outright. And then I also borrowed some money from my parents. So the house was also fairly cheap. So needed $100,000 total, and I was able to come up with about 40 and borrow about 60 from my parents.
Do you think there's anything that you learned by not going through a professional that is maybe applicable to other parts of your life?
One nice thing about it was that, you know, I sat down on the guy's porch and we talked to him. There wasn't a lawyer in between us. It wasn't like I was behind my lawyer and he was behind his lawyer, and now we're neighbors, and it just feels more personal.
Eric, Matt, thank you so much for talking with us.
Yeah, you're welcome.
My name is Paul Wilson. I live in Clatskanie, Oregon, which is a small town or outside of a small town on the far northwest corner of the state of Oregon.
You wrote us that your daughter left school in seventh grade to educate herself. That's a big departure from what I would say most Americans do. Tell me about that.
She had been bugging us for a couple of years to do homeschooling. So we tried send for the curriculum and school the kid, and that didn't work out. She read a book, now outdated, called The Teenage Liberation Handbook, which suggested writing a proposal to your parents, which she did. We said, okay, you propose that you quit. You take 6 months off to kind of orient yourself. She only took about 4. She followed her own interests. I mean, that's what she did. She was enough of a self-starter that we really had to do very little. It worked out very well. She ended up attending college mostly by distance learning, got a degree in business, and works now as a CPA.
That's a remarkable decision to really cut out the middleman. Were you worried that, oh my goodness, what if this fails?
The risk was mostly on the front end, because once we were in the process and saw that she was excited about following up what she was interested in, and she was learning an enormous amount, and that her interests were broad enough to get her a wide-ranging, if somewhat spotty, kind of background, then our comfort level went up. It seemed a very natural thing, and in fact, I was a bit jealous. How come nobody thought of this when I was growing up?
What do you think you've learned from this idea of trying to do things on your own?
That you can learn basic skills for almost anything by checking a book out of the library and trying to do it, and mostly you'll succeed.
Paul Wilson, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Okay. You guys have a good time, and I hope this works out well for you.
For next week's show, the U.S. Census says fewer Americans moved last year than ever before. So we want to know, why did you pick the city you live in now? Family? Friends? Great museums? Money? The love of your life? The former love of your life? We want to hear your stories. So tell us. Just visit MarketplaceWeekend.org or on Twitter, we're at MarketplaceWKND. In space, no one can hear you scream. That's the famous tagline for Alien, Ridley Scott's terrifying 1979 science fiction thriller. And if you can get through it without jumping a few times, you're braver than I am. Alien, of course, featured a rather bad-tempered extraterrestrial that hunted and killed most of the crew of the spaceship Nostromo. The movie spawned 3 sequels and now a blockbuster video game, Alien Isolation. It's described by one reviewer as an exercise in nerve-shredding fear. There's plenty of screaming, but also a lot of quieter fear.
The BBC's Mike Johnson spoke to the game's senior sound designer, Byron Bullock, about the challenge of creating a world full of horror in sound.
I think sound is quite an emotional medium. It works on like a subconscious level almost, so it has the power to kind of push you in certain ways emotionally. It can make you feel anxious, scared, happy, and all kinds of different emotions. And that's a really important thing when we're creating a horror experience, because we want to push the player emotionally in different directions, and sound's a really important tool in doing that.
Yeah, and visually it's quite striking, this game. It takes place on a very dark space station. Your job is to create a parallel world in sound. That must be quite a challenge. And is it all done with computers in terms of creating the sounds for this game?
It's always recorded live, so we record as much real material out in the world as possible. We do use computers to process those sounds and create something that you might not find in the real world, but like 90% of the sound is made from real recordings. So we'll do Foley recordings, so we'll go down and we'll record an artist basically doing actions on screen, so that, and we'll record all the footsteps and the sound of their clothes moving. And another kind of thing that we did was recording the sound of metal shrieking and groaning, because obviously you're on the Sevastopol, which is a big, giant, decommissioned space station, so we needed the sound of this big, giant, almost creaking, moving space station, who's almost a character in the game. So, yeah, we record everything from scratch, really, everything.
And a big character, obviously, in this is the alien itself.
So the creature sounds, they're a mixture of, like, reptilian sounds, so reptilian recordings, lizards, alligators, things like that, and also human sounds processed and kind of all mixed together to create a vocal for the alien.
And what for you is the most exciting, the most dramatic sound moment in this game then?
It's a bit of a tough one, because I think there's lots of great moments, but I think some of the best moments that stand out to me, because one of the things you've got to understand is Alien Isolation, the story is quite a linear thing, but the main gameplay behind it, so the interaction between you and the alien is quite dynamic. So it's quite a challenge for the sound team to create a system that could almost preempt what was happening and could tell what the alien was doing and could basically tell what the player was doing and change the sound based on that. So some of the best moments for me are when they're quite simple. The player's, for example, hiding underneath a table as the alien moves past, and the sound engine knows what the player's doing and it will react to that and it will change the music. And it will change the mix of the game, all to try and make the feeling of tension and kind of heighten everything. And that's probably some of the best moments for me, because it happens dynamically. It's not something that we can script.
That story came to us in partnership with the BBC. That's it. That's Marketplace Weekend for this week. Next week, your stories of why you live where you live. Marketplace Weekend is produced by Raghu Manavalan and Jenny Ament, with help from John Sepulvedo. Dan Semitovich is our senior producer. Jeff Peters and Daniel Ramirez are our engineers. Our theme music is composed by Naren Rao. Deborah Clark is Marketplace's executive producer and vice president. I'm Lizzie O'Leary. Thanks for listening. This is APM.